Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to EMed Home's EMcast. This is Amal Mattu from University of Maryland School of Medicine, and welcome to the May edition of EMcast. Well, this is actually a very special month. This is actually episode number 200. This is our 200th consecutive month of doing EMcast since we started in September 2007. It's amazing that we've been around as long as we have, and all of you subscribers have stuck it out for all of this time. As I've said before, it's unfortunate that at the end of this calendar year, EMed Home is going to be retiring, and with that, EMcast will retire also. But we are looking at some other ideas, and at the very least, I think what we're going to do is we're going to continue doing podcasts of cardiovascular topics that are relevant for acute care medicine, and we're going to put those on a separate website called ECG Weekly, www.ecgweekly. That's a separate website in which every Monday I post ECG video cases. And so we'll kind of consolidate a lot of emergency cardiology stuff on that website. Again, www.ecgweekly.com. And as for the non-cardiac topics, we're looking at some other options. But anyway, I just really, really want to express my appreciation for all of the subscribers that have been with us for so long. Some people have been with us since 2007. Others are subscribing in more recent years. And also, there's a lot of folks that are listening free access through some of the emergency medicine periodicals that post the podcast as well. So my appreciation to everybody, and also to all of the people that have contributed their time in being commentators on all of these great articles. Speaking of emergency cardiology, just one more reminder that in June, we're going to be having our next edition of our emergency electrocardiography course. Is a two-day boot camp, as I call it, two-day boot camp type of course in emergency electrocardiography. Tuesday, June 11th is day number one, and it's entirely focused on acute coronary syndrome, ischemia, mimics, and so on. And then Wednesday, June 12th is day two, and that's entirely focused on arrhythmias and syncope. It is intermediate to advanced level. It's really not a beginner course. And we've gotten some amazing feedback over the years about that course also. You can check out the website at emcardio.com. Again, it is about a 14, 15-hour course between the 2 days. All right, well, on to this month, episode number 200 for EMcast. We got four topics for you. We're going to kick things off with Dr. Rob Flint. He's going to spend some time talking about some recent articles that focused on emergency medicine risk management, some really important stuff, not only about medical malpractice type of stuff, but also certain things that we can do to improve patient care and decrease risk, decrease bad outcomes. Then Lloyd Tannenbaum is going to be joining us from New Jersey. He's going to be spending some time talking about what else but cardiovascular medicine. In this particular podcast, he's going to be focused more on the vascular part than the cardio part. He's going to talk about some recent literature on cervical artery dissection. Then we're going to bring in Dr. Gabriella Miller. Dr. Miller is one of our faculty development fellows and a rising star in emergency medicine, and you're going to be hearing her on the speaking circuit. She's going to spend some time talking about hypoglycemia, not just plain old hypoglycemia where you give somebody a turkey sandwich and discharge them. Now we're talking about patients that have recurrent over and over and over episodes of hypoglycemia despite eating three or four or five turkey sandwiches in your emergency department. Why does this happen, and what can you do to help treat those patients? And then Dr. Rob Flint is going to rejoin us for the last topic, which is going to focus on geriatric psychiatric emergencies. And so four topics this month, four great bits of education. Let's go ahead and get started. All right, well, welcome back to EMcast. And kicking things off this month, we want to spend a little bit of time talking about risk management. And the reason for that is that recently, over the past several months, there have been a handful of articles, maybe just coincidentally, but they just seem to have come out recently, focused on various malpractice issues and risk management issues in emergency medicine. And they relate to faculty, attendings, they relate to residents, and so on. And putting all these together, we figured it would be worth discussing them. So one of my colleagues that you've heard many times before, mostly talking about trauma, Dr. Rob Flint, is back, and he's going to take us through some of these articles. Rob has not only a significant interest in trauma, but during a large portion of his career, he served as a leader within the emergency department systems that he's been in before, medical director and such. And so he's had to do a lot of reviewing of QA cases, I'm sure, and perhaps even medical malpractice cases, unfortunately. And also for those people out there in the world that are listening to this EMcast who may not be in a highly litigious area, this type of stuff is still very relevant to you all as well, because whether you live in an area that has a lot of lawyers or not, none of us want to make mistakes. None of us want to ever get things wrong and certainly be accused of getting things wrong. So I think all of this is very, very relevant to all of us. And so, Rob, welcome back to the EMcast. I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Thanks, Amelie. It's great to be back.
Well, let's go ahead and start our discussion with an article that was published. Actually, this one is a few years old. This was published in the Journal of Emergency Medicine, actually back in 2018, but we never talked about it back then. This was written by Brian Ferguson and colleagues, and it talked about malpractice in emergency medicine, a review of risk and mitigation practices for the emergency medicine provider. And what pearls can we get from this particular article?
Yeah, Amal, I think you summed it up really nicely. Even though we're talking about risk management, it's really about protecting patients. So hopefully we can come up with a few pearls that will help us protect our patients and us for those that practice in a more litigious area. The thing that surprised me about the data they presented is emergency physicians really are considered a moderate risk for malpractice claims, very similar to other specialties. Most EM claims do not end in payment. And while we all live in tremendous fear every shift of being sued, the data shows emergency physicians aren't losing cases or being named in suits disproportionately to any other medical specialty. So it should make us feel a little better that we aren't overly represented in the malpractice claims.
That's a bit of a surprise because I think we all assume that emergency medicine is higher risk than most other specialties. But did the authors find any particular themes in the cases that they reviewed that we can learn from?
Yes, they actually found several diagnoses which are higher risks. So if we look at chest pain or missed MI, missed fractures, abdominal pain, which really meant missed appendicitis, wounds, especially those with retained foreign bodies, missed cerebral vascular accidents or intracranial hemorrhages, as well as missed aortic aneurysms, and then pediatric fever and meningitis also are prevalent in the malpractice literature. If I quote the authors, they say specific preventable errors are consistently associated with litigious situations. They include diagnostic fallacy, failure to document, particularly family history, medical decision-making, and reassessment, as well as poor communication with patients. If you have a history of adverse relationships or malpractice, you're at a higher risk of having future suits, as well as if you don't follow up on diagnostic testing. And they also noted sleep deprivation, ED crowding, and nursing flow, of course, are also associated with increased risk. I actually think it comes down to the three Ds: dialogue, documentation, and discharge. So, dialogue or communication, if you're perceived as someone who spends time with a patient and offers reassessment and offers updates, you're much less likely to be sued. There are a few studies out there that show if just pulling up a chair and sitting makes you look like you're in the room longer than you are. So I really encourage everyone to have a seat, introduce yourself, and make sure the patient and the patient's family understand your plan and your thought process. When it comes to documentation, make sure you review the nursing documentation, look at old records, and any other collaborating notes you may find. Make sure your note's complete, accurate, and addresses all of your medical decision making. Make sure you address any contraindications between your note and nursing note. There's always going to be some conflict, so just make sure that you address it. The patient's story changes, as we all know. And the last D is discharge. Reevaluate your patient prior to discharge. Make sure they have normal discharge vital signs. Make sure you have complete, legible discharge instructions that specifically outline return precautions and what the patient needs to do next.
The three Ds, I love that. Dialogue, documentation, and discharge. I remember attending a Med Mal conference many years ago where the speakers who were extremely involved in serving as experts in medical malpractice cases for one side or the other consistently said that discharge instructions often were the sole thing that turned the case in a positive or negative way. In on a 25, I think it was about 25% of cases ended up hinging on the discharge instructions. And I think it's really worth taking some extra time there in terms of documentation, focusing in particular on discharge instructions. So I appreciate you really emphasizing that. Now, you mentioned diagnostic fallacy was a leading cause of litigation. What exactly does that mean?
The authors use this category to include inadequate supervision, poor handoffs or sign outs, and those less experienced providers just having gaps in clinical knowledge.
All right. Well, moving on to our second article, speaking of supervision and also less experienced providers, this article was published in Academic Emergency Medicine just this past year, 2023. And the lead author was Peter Antkowiak, titled this article, Characterizing Malpractice Cases Involving Emergency Department Advanced Practice Providers, Physicians in Training, and Attending Physicians. So this is extremely relevant to all of us working in academic medical centers and many community hospitals that work with nurse practitioners and PAs. So why is this article of interest to you in particular, and also why should the rest of our audience be interested in this article?
So we know there's been significant debate about the rise of the use of nurse practitioners and physician's assistants in the emergency department over the last several years. And this debate's really rotated around cost, resource utilization, and training. This article looks at it a little differently. It looks at the malpractice risk, and it points out that by 2030, around 20% of all ED patients are going to be seen by advanced practice providers. So if we set aside any of the other controversies, it's really good to look at what drives malpractice claims, what drives risk when we're associated with advanced practice providers. And then we know trainees, such as medical students, residents, and fellows, also probably are at higher risk for these. And so we need to figure out how to protect ourselves and our patients in these scenarios.
Now, this was actually a research study, so can you give us a kind of a broad overview of what the authors did in this study?
Yeah, I thought it was really well done. They looked at 9 years of data from a really large database that contained around 33% of all malpractice claims in the US. They weeded it down to 5,400 ED cases, which 3% were involving a nurse practitioner, 9% a PA, 9% one of the trainees, and then the rest were basically attendings. And in terms of money paid out, trainees cases paid out the most, followed by nurse practitioners, PAs, and then attending cases paid out the least. If we slice it a little differently, they looked at the severity of injury. And in that case, non-extender cases and trainee cases had about 50% of the cases, which makes sense because they're seeing the higher acuity and it kind of correlates with the current emergency department workforce. They were able to really look down into this data and find some common diagnoses and errors that led to malpractice claims and closed malpractice cases.
Now, for those that do work with APPs, Advanced Practice Providers, which essentially refers to PAs and NPs, or maybe for soon to graduate residents that are going to be working with the APPs in their new jobs, what are the take-home points that they should keep in mind?
So I think the overarching themes around malpractice claims associated with PAs and nurse practitioners was clinical judgment, documentation, and supervision. Areas of particular concern involved infections, fracture care, and missed ruptures of the aorta, appendix, and tendons. And then cerebral vascular disease was also a high area of prevalent malpractice claim. So most errors were secondary to misdiagnoses, as well as medical treatment and medication errors. So these are the type of patients that you have to have an ongoing education process with your advanced practice providers, and you have to have physician involvement.
And I've consulted in a handful of med mal cases that did involve APPs. And I'll tell you that the physicians always get drawn in for issues related to inadequate supervision. And so, depending on what your hospital protocol is, you may be responsible for all of those charts. Maybe not, but you need to make sure that you know what your hospital protocol is. And if you're responsible for those charts and those patients that the APPs are seeing, you've really got to do an adequate job in supervising. Now, for those of us that are working with emergency medicine trainees, residents, house staff of whatever type, what should we be watching for?
So in this particular study, they found that trainee cases involving malpractice involved complications, lack of technical skills, and a higher percentage of system-related issues. So we need to be cautious around procedures, make sure we're doing adequate supervision during a procedure, and that we adequately identify those high-risk procedures and make sure the resident feels comfortable in those situations. And we really cannot overstate the complexity of navigating the medical system while we're still trying to learn medicine as a whole. That's why medical system issues were so prevalent in the trainee cases. Clinical judgment, communication, and documentation were also areas of concern with trainees. And then there's a third article that we looked at from March of 2023 in injury prevention that looked specifically at trainee malpractice cases, and they found exactly the same type of things: lack of supervision leading to failure to diagnose, incorrect treatment, and procedure errors. They also pointed out that cases involving trainees were much more likely to end with a payout and end with a verdict in favor of the patient. So these really truly are high-risk cases.
Great. And so just for reference purposes, that third article that Dr. Flint is referring to is first author is Christopher Poyorina. I hope I'm getting that right. And the article is titled A Review of Medical Malpractice Cases Involving Trainees in the Emergency Department. This was published in the Injury Prevention section of the Journal of the American College of Emergency Physicians, which is an open access journal. And Rob, kind of summing up some of this information about how to mitigate the risk associated with APPs and trainees, what would you say that the listeners should know about that particular topic?
I think all of these authors suggest, and I actually agree, that real-time direct supervision is the key to limiting these type of cases. So you have to have a system that's built around allowing collaboration with your APP colleagues as well as trainees, and that's going to help decrease medical errors. So you have to be available. You have to be there for real time. You can't just be sending the chart at the end of your shift or 2 days later. And you really have to be open to collaboration. They have to feel comfortable coming to you and discussing the nuances of the case and asking for help. So if you're an open, willing participant in the process, you're going to be much more likely to avoid these cases. And if you have to put some documentation on the chart, they really find that the patient and all the providers involved are much more protected.
Great, great points. Rob, can you just kind of wrap up our overall discussion with a few key take-home points for the listeners?
Yeah, well, I think we should go back to the three Ds we spoke about earlier, the dialogue or communication. Take the time to introduce yourself, have a seat, keep the patient and family updated on your plans, and do a regular reevaluation on the patient. For documentation, you do a ton of thinking on a shift. Put it in the chart. You know, you should get credit from the billers for this, but you also protect yourself and your patient from bad outcomes. And then when we talk about discharge, reevaluate, reevaluate, reevaluate. Make sure the patient can ambulate to assess their ability to ambulate and as well as their physiologic ability to get around and function. Make sure you have normal vital signs at discharge and then send the patient home with clear instructions to follow up and when to return. I think a great example of this is in undifferentiated abdominal pain. Have them come back in 12 to 24 hours for a recheck. This is going to help you miss appendicitis or miss ruptured appendicitis. And it's a really nice protective mechanism for you and for your patient.
Really great points, Rob. Thanks so much for your time and going through three articles with this particular podcast. And I think these are some really, really important tips, not only to prevent malpractice, but also most importantly, to improve patient care. So Rob, hope to get you back on EMCast before too long. I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Samuel.
All right. Well, next up on EMCast, we're going to spend some time talking about cervical artery dissection. That's something that I don't think that we've talked about in quite some time. We talked about it in the setting of trauma, but not as a general topic, at least not for as long as I can remember. The reason we're going to talk about it is because there is a nice article published recently, 2024, I think it was February 2024, in American Journal of Emergency Medicine by Britt Long and colleagues, a nice review on the topic. And, you know, I have to say, it's not something that I ever learned about in residency. So I don't know whether human beings just suddenly started having dissections or, well, more likely our imaging technology and diagnostic capabilities have improved. And we've learned about some complications of having this diagnosis. And I think our neurology folks and trauma folks are finding these more than I would have imagined when I first heard about this. So anyway, it's bottom line is something that I think we need to know about and be on the lookout for and know what to do when we find it. Well, fortunately, joining me is a colleague from New Jersey that you've heard a number of times before. Dr. Lloyd Tenenbaum is back. Lloyd, I've always thought of as our cardiac guy, but I'm going to expand the way I think of him, and think of him as a cardiovascular guy, since we're going to talk about the cervical artery rather than just the coronary artery. So first of all, Lloyd, welcome back to EMcast. It's great to talk to you again.
Hey, Amal, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here with you.
All right, so we're going to extend your niche up into the brain just a little bit, up into the neck at least, and talk about the vessels up there. So let's go ahead and jump right in. Let's walk through this article and address some of the common questions on this topic. Lloyd, first off, what exactly is cervical artery dissection?
I'm going to do my best to get it right the entire talk. I am more used to heart things, but we'll see how I do with going a little bit further north. A spontaneous cervical artery dissection involves either the carotid or the vertebral artery, and it occurs as a result of a compromise of the arterial wall layers. A dissection can lead to luminal stenosis, and that can cause hypoperfusion or thromboembolic complications. Cervical artery dissections can cause strokes in younger patients. It carries a significant morbidity and mortality. It's not a very common disease. The incidence of the internal carotid dissection is only about 1.72 patients per 100,000 individuals. And for vertebral artery dissection, it's even more rare. It's about 1 per 100,000. So, Amal, interestingly, cervical artery dissection accounts for about 2% of all strokes, but in patients under 45 years old, it's closer to 15 to 25% of strokes.
All right. Well, that's some very, very nice information. And my initial feeling was to call this coronary artery dissection also, but we're both going to practice this cervical artery
I
dissection.
will get it right by the end, I promise.
All right. Well, what causes these artery dissections?
So if we look at the pathophysiology, let's just kind of do that and get that out of the way. A dissection is a tear in the layers of the arterial walls, and it leads to a false lumen. With this false lumen, the blood can go between the layers of the artery, and this will significantly weaken the walls of that vessel, and it could lead to a couple bad things. It can lead to hemorrhage, or it can lead to a vascular wall rupture. So if the vessel doesn't rupture, what else can happen? Well, the dissection of the vessel can cause the true lumen to get much smaller than it should be, and you can form a hematoma. Both of these, a dissection and a hematoma, are bad, and can cause cerebral ischemia from hypoperfusion, thromboembolus, or both. Also, please be aware that as the dissection gets bigger or the hematoma gets bigger, it can compress other structures such as nerves and vessels, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So these patients can present with some weird kind of vague neurosymptoms, and imaging can show a dissection due to putting pressure on surrounding structures. If you're curious about how this happens, well, spontaneous is in the name, right? Spontaneous cervical artery dissection. Literature suggests that about 41% of cases occur due to some minor cervical trauma, although over a third of patients will not remember any inciting event. Typical trauma includes, and this is going to sound a little bit wild, chiropractic manipulation, minor sports injuries, painting a ceiling, dancing with head movements, intense coughing, sneezing, or vomiting, childbirth, Valsalva during childbirth or the postpartum period, neck cracking, whiplash, yoga, scuba diving, weightlifting, trampoline jumping, or roller coasters. So in conclusion, just about anything can do this, or nothing can do this. It kind of comes out of nowhere.
All right. Well, a good reason to not paint the ceiling, I guess. So,
Exactly.
yeah, I mean, essentially living your life can be associated with this. And my guess, some of those things make sense, like chiropractic manipulation, where somebody's actually manipulating your neck, that makes sense. Or whiplash, that kind of makes sense. But a lot of these others just seem like normal life events. And I would imagine that if somebody has a dissection, they can look back and say, oh, yeah, yesterday I was painting the ceiling, or maybe I was shaving and turning my head a certain way. And, that's just normal life stuff. So who knows with these very, very minor trauma type of things. But again, it's something that we've got to be on the lookout. And, there are certain things I would imagine that really put people at higher risk involving neck manipulations and jerking of the neck, or whatever. But I think we need to be on the lookout for cases where there really is no precipitating cause. Some of the mechanisms that you mentioned seem really, really common. And yet, coronary dissections are obviously not occurring in every single person who gives birth, for example. Are there certain risk factors, and maybe this is more important than the mechanism, but are there certain risk factors or patients that are at higher risk for developing this with those
Yeah,
things?
absolutely. No, those are good questions. I'm going to hope roller coasters is not one of the higher risk factors because I'm a big fan, but perhaps I should kind of reassess my life choices after reading this article. Looking at what the authors describe, the biggest risk factor putting patients at a higher risk is a vascular or connective tissue disorder. Some of these include fibromuscular dysplasia, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, Marfan syndrome, osteogenesis imperfecta, or polycystic kidney disease. Some other risk factors to be aware of are recent infections, head and neck surgery, cardiovascular risk factors such as smoking, migraines, oral contraceptives, hypertension, an elongated styloid process, or pregnancy. I don't know how you would know you had an elongated styloid process unless you just happened to have a CT or something, but you know, it's kind of a cool risk factor out there. I didn't know size varied in styloid processes.
All right. Well, how do these patients typically present clinically?
Oh boy. So this one's going to run a little bit of a gambit here. This is one of those diseases that unfortunately you're probably going to miss on initial presentation. According to the authors, on average, there's a delay in diagnosis by about 9 days after the initial visit to the emergency room or primary care doctor, which is a little bit terrifying. Most patients will present with neck pain or a headache, which is unfortunately pretty nonspecific and pretty common in the ER. The headache can be either a gradual onset headache getting progressively worse or more scarily described as worst headache of life. It usually will eventually become a severe unilateral headache, often on the same side as the dissection. Depending on the artery involved, if it's the carotid artery, you're worried about a frontal or a temporal headache. For a vertebral artery dissection, it's often a posterior headache. You can also see some complaints of pain in the ear, eyes, teeth, or face in about 35% of patients. And this is more common with a carotid dissection. And you'll see neck pain, which is more common in a vertebral dissection. And just to make it a little bit more unfair, about 8% of patients will come in only complaining of some vague head or neck pain and not have any other symptoms to help you on your way. You know, earlier, Amal, we talked briefly about an expanding hematoma or an enlarging pseudoaneurysm putting some mass effect on surrounding structures. You know, let's dive in a little bit deeper there. We can also see patients presenting with Horner syndrome due to distension of the sympathetic fibers or cranial neuropathies due to compression of the cranial nerves. Interestingly, cranial nerve 12 is the most commonly affected cranial nerve here, followed by cranial nerve 9. Patients may also complain of pulsatile tinnitus too. These patients can present with some pretty benign sounding things like vague headache, vague neck pain. They can also present with some pretty severe stroke-like symptoms. Risk of stroke is highest in the first 2 weeks following the dissection. The stroke symptoms we see kind of line up with the area that the vessel that's affected perfuses. So for a carotid artery dissection, you're going to worry about monocular blindness. You're going to worry about unilateral extremity weakness and some sensory changes. Whereas with vertebral artery dissections, you can see posterior circulation strokes or a cervical spine infarction. So remember, for those posterior circulation strokes that kind of keep us up at night and haunt us, symptoms include severe vertigo, ataxia, dysmetria, nausea, vomiting, vision changes, and weakness. For a C-spine infarct, you're going to worry about extremity weakness or sensory changes. And finally, if the dissection extends all the way up intracranially, we can actually see a subarachnoid hemorrhage if it starts to leak. These patients, we expect altered mental status, focal neurodeficits, and a severe headache. So if I had to put this all together in a nice little box, I feel pretty comfortable telling you that it could be almost nothing to almost something terrible, and there's a lot in between.
All right. Well, the article also mentions some mimics of cervical artery dissection. Can you briefly review those?
Absolutely. So dangerous mimics include a subarachnoid hemorrhage, an intracerebral hemorrhage, a reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome, cerebral infection such as meningitis or an abscess, cerebral venous thrombosis, hypertensive encephalopathy, posterior reversible leukoencephalopathy syndrome, pituitary apoplexy, giant cell arteritis, and acute angle closure glaucoma. The article itself did have a nice little chart running through each one of these. I don't think we have the time to dive into each one of these disease processes individually, but I would keep in the back of your head that like a broad differential, a very thorough neuro exam on these patients, and sometimes like a lucky CT scan can save the day.
Okay. So Lloyd, once we suspect the diagnosis based on some of the maybe the more concerning symptoms, I'm guessing that that's more likely the time that we're going to make the diagnosis as opposed to the very vague symptoms. But once we suspect the diagnosis, how do we work them up?
So, you know, in the ER, the most readily available test that we have is a CTA of the head and neck. And that is usually able to show you the dissection flap. So sensitivity and specificity for a CTA with contrast is over 90%. On CTA, you'd expect to see a thrombus, focal stenosis, distal dilation, intimal flap, double lumen, luminal occlusion, pseudoaneurysm, something like that that would tip you off that there's something going on with the vessels that is not normal. Now, if you're really, really suspicious, I don't know, maybe you just like have some spidey sense tingling or something, and you feel like this is probably a dissection, but your CTA is inconclusive, you can always progress to an MRI-MRA if that's a test that's available to you. You know, at my shop, we would have to admit a patient to get those, but we have, you know, great neuro colleagues, great neurointensivists, neurosurgeons. Like, if we're worried about it, they're always willing to get on board and help us work it up. On an MRI-MRA, you would expect to see an intraluminal hematoma, an intimal flap, a double lumen, a vessel dilation, or a pseudoaneurysm. So some of the same findings you'd expect on a CTA, just MRI might be able to pick it up a little bit better. And Amo, we've talked about this a couple times. In this day and age, we're always worried about ultrasound and how can we use that and how can we be better with it. We can use ultrasound to help look for these. It's good for ruling the diagnosis in. It's not perfect at ruling the diagnosis out. On the ultrasound, you'd expect to see a dissection or a flap or an intramural hematoma. It's not perfect. And then again, you'll kind of lose the artery as it goes into the skull. So this is not the test to rule out a dissection. However, you can use it to rule it in if you see some concerning findings. Finally, I just wanted to briefly touch on the gold standard for this diagnosis. It would be called digital subtraction angiography. And some of us on this podcast may have done a quick Google search to find out what digital subtraction angiography is, since I had never heard of that before. But after my search, I can tell you that it's a fluoroscopic technique that's done in the IR suite, and it's used to better see blood vessels. So what happens is radio opaque structures are digitally subtracted from the image until they're just left with the blood vessels. And then you're able to get a very good view of what the vessels look like and see if there's any flaps or not. Again, this is the gold standard to diagnose the disease of a dissection. However, it does have risks such as stroke, bleeding, and pseudoaneurysm formation. So you're like definitely going to need to get some colleagues on board before you do this. I mean, this isn't even a test I think I could order in the ER even if I wanted to. So you need to talk to neuro, neurocrit, maybe vascular, neurosurgery. Honestly, a lot of people before this test gets done.
Got it. All right. Now, if we do make this diagnosis, what do we do for treating the patients?
It really depends on what symptoms are present and what we see on imaging. So again, we're going to need to get our consultants on board, and then they're going to help kind of guide us. If there's evidence of an ischemic stroke, cervical artery dissection is not a contraindication for thrombolytics. There was a 2009 retrospective study that found no difference in rates of intracranial hemorrhage or recurrent ischemic stroke in patients with dissection-induced ischemic strokes versus those not due to a dissection. So if you find the dissection, but the patient has no stroke-like symptoms and no bleed on imaging, you know, now what do we do? Well, prevention of the ischemic stroke is the important part. These patients may be started on anticoagulation, which reduces the risk of stroke from 27 to 50-ish% down to 3 to 4%. However, there's a lot of risk factors that decide on what kind of anticoagulation the patients need. Do they need heparin? Do they need Coumadin? Do they need some antiplatelet? Should they just take an aspirin? You know, this is not something that you as the ER doctor is going to be able to figure out on your own. You're going to need to bring in some specialists to help guide you on what the patient should be started on. There's also some patients who would need some sort of endovascular intervention, such as stenting, angioplasty, or embolization. But these are usually patients who will have some kind of contraindication to anticoagulation or recurrent strokes despite optimal medical therapy, or a severe occlusion or narrowing that you see on imaging. They may also have a large vessel occlusion or severely compromised blood flow, or pseudoaneurysm that's enlarging. So if they have any of these higher risk findings, they're often going to need to go to the lab and get some sort of endovascular intervention, such as the stent. You might also be curious as to what we should do for these patients' blood pressure. You know, if they come in with a blood pressure of 182 over 112, am I worried about that? If their blood pressure is 160, am I worried about that? Like, where's the cutoff and what should we do? So there's really no clear data for blood pressure management, although it is something that tends to concern us. If the patient's coming in with an ischemic stroke-like symptoms and they're a thrombolytic candidate, the goal of less than 185 systolic over 110 is a reasonable goal. And if the patient has a subarachnoid hemorrhage, a goal less than 160 is reasonable. The biggest point that the authors point out here is that your big goal is to avoid hypotension. And a blood pressure goal for dissection hasn't been, you know, discovered yet, but hypotension is more concerning than hypertension in these patients.
All right, got it. All right, so with these therapies above, what is the long-term prognosis for these patients?
You know, interestingly, 60 to 85% of these patients will completely heal in about 12 months. recurrent ischemia occurs at a rate between 0 to 13% at 1 year, although the risk of stroke is highest the first 2 weeks after the dissection occurs. Recurrence rate of dissection ranges from 2 to 16%, although most occur within the first few months of the initial diagnosis. So, for, you know, from what I was reading, it sounds like if you make it through the first couple weeks to first couple months, you have a pretty high likelihood of recovering from this completely. Function and outcome depends on the presence or absence of the associated ischemic stroke or subarachnoid hemorrhage. The majority of cervical artery dissection patients have a favorable outcome with a mortality rate less than 5%. So it's a scary sounding disease, but it sounds like if you make it through the initial process, you tend to have pretty good outcomes and a pretty good recovery.
Fantastic. Well, Lloyd, that was a great discussion. Any final take-home points you'd like to leave the listeners with?
I guess the big take-homes for me was that this is a pretty tricky disease process. To catch it, you need a high index of suspicion, you know, a really, really thorough neuro exam, and a little bit of luck. This is probably one of those patients that you might be thinking like, oh, I feel like I should get a CT scan. I can't really explain why. And just like, it feels like I should get one. Like, get the CT scan. Nobody's going to fault you for that. I think you should sleep better at night and get more imaging than worry about it. I'd also remember that these patients come in with a variety of chief complaints, from like my neck feels a little tingly to I have this like crippling stroke or a head bleed. So just, you know, keep in the back of your mind that on these patients who come in with my neck feels funny, and it's always possible it's a dissection. And then finally, if you do find a cervical artery dissection, you're going to need to bring your consultant friends in. You're going to talk to neurosurgery, neurology, vascular, neurocritical care. You know, you're going to need some help managing these patients. They're complex and, you know, don't go at it solo.
All right. Great. Great pearls to leave listeners with. Lloyd, thanks so much for your time. And we will try to get you back with a heart issue rather than a separate vascular issue. And until then, please stay well.
Thanks so much, Amal. It was fun, you know, branching outside the heart a little bit.
Okay. Talk to you later, Lloyd.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, let's turn our attention to hypoglycemia. You know, I had a patient recently, maybe about a week ago or so, a 60-some-year-old woman who came to the emergency department, and apparently she was found a little bit altered. Turned out that she had taken her insulin, hadn't eaten as much as normal. She was hypoglycemic, so no big deal. She got some dextrose in the field, and by the time she arrived in the emergency department, she was completely awake and alert, and figured that she was just going to eat a meal in the emergency department and be discharged. So sure enough, she ate something, and we watched her for a little bit, and an hour and a half later, despite eating a standard emergency department ration of a turkey sandwich or whatever it was, her finger stick fell back down into the 40s again. Fortunately, her mental status was okay, so she ate some more, and we rechecked her finger stick a couple hours later, and it was back down to the 40s and 50s. So she ate some more, and this went on and on through the course of an entire shift and then into the next shift. And none of us could figure out what was causing this hypoglycemia. She wasn't continuing to take insulin. She hadn't overdosed on anything. She wasn't doing anything. She wasn't receiving any new medications, but it was very confusing what was causing all this. She ended up being admitted, and I need to follow up on what exactly they came up with. But fortunately, there was an article that came out in Annals of Emergency Medicine on managing adults with hypoglycemia that hopefully is here to provide some answers. It was published just this past December by Christopher Watson and Jonathan Edlow. Dr. Edlow is well known for his expertise in emergency neurology, but he really knows a lot about a lot. And so it's not surprising that he's an author on this article. And so we're going to go through this article. Joining me to help get us through this article and teach us something about hypoglycemia is one of my colleagues, Dr. Gabriella Miller. Gabriella has been on the EMCast before. She's one of our junior faculty, and she is doing a faculty development fellowship and ASEP's teaching fellowship. And she is bursting onto the scene in terms of education at more of a national level. She spoke at our recent Crashing Patient Conference, and she will be speaking in just a couple of weeks, mid-February, at the Rocky Mountain Winter Conference in Steamboat. And no doubt you're going to be hearing more from Gabriella about assorted topics in the coming years. So Gabriella, first of all, welcome back to EMCast. It's great to have you back.
So glad to be back and excited to talk about this topic. I've also had some recent interesting hypoglycemia cases, and I feel like I have definitely a better framework for navigating and helping these patients.
Yeah, I think this is really confusing, because when it's an overdose, it's pretty straightforward. And you just, I guess, give them octreotide. And if it's, I took my insulin, I forgot to eat, then you just give them a meal and they can pretty much go home. But anyway, this framework that you know about, hopefully you're going to share that with us along with the key points from this article. So let's go ahead and jump in. We'll start with some basics. And maybe you can start out by just telling us, what are the typical presenting symptoms of hypoglycemia? We'll start out basic.
So this article categorizes the symptoms of hypoglycemia into two categories, adrenergic symptoms and neuroglycopenic symptoms. The adrenergic symptoms are kind of the classic shakes, sweats, drowsiness, and hunger that we've all probably have felt at least one time in our lives. The neuroglycopenic symptoms, however, like refer directly to CNS involvement, and those are the worst case scenario of hypoglycemia. It includes like delirium, seizures, and coma. Importantly, patients with neuroglycopenic symptoms can present with signs or symptoms that mimic alternate pathologies, which is why we check a finger stick with all of our stroke patients, since patients who are very profoundly hypoglycemic can appear intoxicated, or like a patient with a head injury, meningitis, or like I mentioned before, a stroke. It's worth noting that patients with diabetes and some more rare causes of very high insulin levels may not have as robust of an adrenergic response to hypoglycemia. And since they don't sense those cues early, they may not be able to treat their low blood sugar. And so that puts them at an increased risk for neuroglycopenic symptoms. So those patients may go from like zero to 100 really quickly, or I guess I should say 100 to zero in terms of their sugar really quickly, and then have a lot of symptoms.
Got it. Well, of course, with Dr. Edlow being involved, I figured there had to be some neuro stuff that came in here. So there we go. Well, the authors next talk about the causes of hypoglycemia, and they split these into various categories, which I never really thought about before. But let's start with their first category, which is exogenous causes. What does this refer to?
This refers to basically prescribed pharmaceuticals or toxic ingestions. Most ingestions cause a non-ketotic state, except for ethanol and then some medications that may cause a mixed state or a mild ketosis. There are so many medications on the list of exogenous sources of hypoglycemia. And one of the, some of the ones that I noted that I think I was a little bit surprised about were NSAIDs, Depakote, SNRIs, and some antibiotics. Because all of these medications have variable mechanisms of action, they also have variable mechanisms of action for producing hypoglycemia. I think the important point here is to consider that many more medications cause hypoglycemia than we traditionally consider. So if a patient presents with an overdose of any kind of medication, it's pretty important that we investigate upfront if that medication can result in hypoglycemia and monitor and treat patients appropriately.
Yeah, that was a bit of a surprise to me also. I had no idea that there are so many medications that can produce hypoglycemia. But anyway, next up, they talk about concurrent illness. What do we need to know about this section?
So the concurrent illness category refers to some other unrelated or seemingly unrelated illness that depletes glycogen stores. That's like your sepsis or another critical illness, or impairs renal or hepatic function, which can like impair drug metabolism, thereby causing hypoglycemia, or throws some hormones aside from insulin out of whack in a way that produces hypoglycemia. And those are our adrenal crisis and hypothyroid patients. Interestingly, non-islet cell tumors are also a cause of concurrent illness. I was previously unaware of these. Essentially, these tumors secrete insulin-like growth factor 2 as a paraneoplastic syndrome. Importantly, they tend to present once they're very large and difficult to resect. So it's important to be aware that patients may be living with this type of tumor, may not be able to have a lot of treatment for the tumor, and so we need to know how to monitor and treat them appropriately.
Great. Okay. Well, the third category that they talk about is the, quote, seemingly well, unquote, category. What exactly does that refer to, these seemingly well patients or seemingly well category?
These patients have an isolated hyperinsulinemic state. So this is either from use of insulin, endogenous production from something like an insulinoma, or a post-gastric bypass surgery patient. Gastric bypass procedures are becoming increasingly prevalent including in our teenage and young adult populations. And so I thought I'd just talk a little bit more about these folks. They develop rapid gastric emptying, which results in sharp increases in blood glucose and consequently insulin levels. And the insulin levels tend to actually overshoot beyond what their body needs, resulting in low blood sugar. I think one thing to note about these patients are that this process doesn't happen until 1 to 3 years post-surgery, which points to the importance of taking a thorough surgical history up front. And I think that with patients beside from a recent post-op complication or like a recent belly surgery, we tend to not really think about surgical history quite as much if it doesn't seem related to the patient's complaint. But this is one thing where we kind of should be asking about any belly surgeries and in particular, any gastric bypass procedures.
It's really interesting. That totally new information to me also. All right, well, let's change gears and talk about management. So once we have a patient that we've identified as having hypoglycemia, especially with recurrent hypoglycemia, what should we do in evaluating these patients?
First and foremost, I just want to highlight that we have to actually recognize hypoglycemia as an issue, and we should be using point-of-care glucose liberally as part of our triage process because it can mimic so many other disease processes. But of course, once it's identified and in tandem with treating the hypoglycemia, as well as obtaining a thorough history and physical exam, there's some additional lab work that's worthwhile sending off. If somebody has a clear underlying illness like sepsis, they're febrile, they're tachypneic from their pneumonia, obviously that has to be treated. And we should help support their blood sugar while they're getting treated for their underlying condition. But for the well-appearing patient who has a more unclear etiology, the bare minimum is to obtain some basic labs, including a chemistry and a CBC. The chemistry is supposed to compare the patient's renal and hepatic function to their baseline. Again, that can interfere with drug metabolism and produce hypoglycemia. It's also recommended to get ketones, which can help further characterize what might be precipitating the hypoglycemia. And the authors categorize, again, which states may result in high ketones and hypoglycemia, as well as normal ketones and hypoglycemia. I think the next level for these patients is considering collecting and holding some blood work to send off during a period of hypoglycemia. And this is for all those fancy tests that hopefully the endocrinology colleagues will be able to follow up in clinic, which includes insulin, proinsulin, C-peptide levels, as well as some ones that we're used to sending off like plasma glucose and beta-hydroxybutyrate or whatever ketone assay your particular facility has. Additionally, if the patient has like clear signs of malignancy like B symptoms or an obvious mass on their belly exam, it's important to consider, you know, screening with imaging to figure out exactly what that is and whether it's something that would be amenable to an intervention. For exogenous exposures, the key here is that serial glucose monitoring is imperative. And depending on the length of duration of action of the agents that were ingested, that may need monitoring in an inpatient setting. In particular, this is something that, because there are so many different agents with different mechanisms of action, we may benefit from getting a tox consult or a poison control consult early on so that they can help guide us in terms of how long the patient needs to be monitored and what additional testing they may benefit from.
Got it. In the article, there's a very nice figure or algorithm, which you just summarized very, very nicely. And one of the problems I have with this algorithm is it's probably in like 4-point font, so I need magnifying glasses to see it. So I appreciate your younger eyes being able to translate all of that for me. So now when we see these patients, we give the patient an amp of dextrose or a short infusion of dextrose. And if it solves the problem, great, we're done. But in these quandary type of cases, it often doesn't solve the problem. What do we do next?
So if a patient is able to eat, certainly let them eat, just like you talked about that patient up front. What they eat is a little bit important. In particular, we need to make sure that they're having at least 30 grams of carbs, which amounts to 2 slices of bread. And I've always been taught that 2 slices of bread in the ED usually has turkey in between, and that helping patients to include protein when they're hypoglycemic can blunt further insulin spikes and ensure maintenance of blood sugar stability. So I looked into this, and this is a little bit beyond the scope of the article, but it seems like, according to the Diabetes Association, that the jury is still out on whether protein in the treatment of acute hypoglycemia is actually helpful. So I think whatever you have on hand, juice, bread, crackers, any of that is good stuff. If a single amp of dextrose doesn't do the trick and the patient is unable to readily eat because of debility, inability to take PO intake regularly because of a feeding tube or something along those lines, patients may end up being on a maintenance fluid drip of dextrose-containing fluids. If a patient has a known insulinoma or has ingested an insulin secretagogue like a sulfonylurea, octreotide is indicated in these folks. You can give 50 micrograms every 6 hours sub-Q, and this helps prevent rebound hypoglycemia. God forbid, if a patient loses IV access, you can consider IM glucagon. That being said, glucagon is a pretty unpleasant drug. It can cause vomiting, and it also won't work in some patients, in particular if they don't have any glycogen stores to utilize. It's also contraindicated in patients with hyperinsulinemia or secretagogue ingestion. So it's not really great to give to all comers, but if a patient has glucagon as like a rescue home med, that should be an indication that it's probably okay to give them if they lose IV access.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's say that we are now maintaining the sugar with whatever we've done. Talk to us a little bit about which patients can be discharged, and also what type of things do you say in those discharge instructions that you give the patient?
So the bar for discharging patients with hypoglycemia is rather high. After observing a patient for recurrent hypoglycemia, which typically is at least for 6 hours, length kind of depends on what the precipitating factor was, the patients who are ready for discharge, we need to double check that they don't have an underlying illness driving hypoglycemia. So to just do a sort of a discharge timeout and make sure to review their lab work, their history one last time. We also need to make sure that they're at their baseline in terms of their kidney and liver function. And they, of course, need to be able to eat or take in nutrition through whatever their typical avenue is. Two of the more challenging elements of a safe discharge are to ensure that the patient can be watched at home by somebody who can monitor for recurrent hypoglycemia, like a support person, and then also to make sure that they have short-term follow-up with a primary care doctor or an endocrinologist. And that's to make sure to make any medication adjustments or to follow up on labs that we sent that or send out labs that may take a little bit longer to come back. So assessing a patient's support system and access to outpatient care here is critical. If your patient is ready for discharge and you discuss return precautions with both them and their support person who's going to be monitoring them at home, the things to note are symptoms of hypoglycemia, how to check a blood sugar at home, how to treat hypoglycemia at home, which may or may not include a glucagon rescue kit, when to follow up, and which medications to hold or down titrate. And I think the authors note that the medication adjustments are one of the elements that is frequently forgotten. And so don't be hesitant to dose adjust a patient's insulin, to ask them to hold their glipizide, or make sure that they're not ingesting a medication that in an overdose amounts inappropriately. Those are all critical elements of a safe discharge plan.
Great. Well, that was a really great discussion, Gabriella. Do you have any critical take-home points that you want to leave the listeners with?
Okay. I think that we're all sort of on the same page that we should be liberal with screening for hypoglycemia as a cause for nonspecific symptoms or abnormal neuro exams, but it's always worth reiterating. It's also important that upfront we perform a thorough history, including a full med rec and a surgical history, even though it may be tempting to cut corners sometimes. We need to monitor all patients for at least 6 hours who have hypoglycemia, and sometimes we even need to admit patients if they have recurrent symptoms. And additionally, we also need to consider admitting patients who have limited social support or inadequate follow-up mechanisms because these patients are at high risk for having a recurrence at home alone and may end up coming back to us much, much sicker than we discharged them.
All right, fantastic. Well, Dr. Gabriella Miller, thank you so much for taking us through this article, and look forward to getting you back for some more EM casts. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Well, next up on EMED Homes EMCast, we are going to spend some time talking about geriatric psychiatric emergencies. As you may have realized, we were trying to add a little bit more psych behavioral stuff to the EMCast because we really haven't had much over the years. So we've added a touch more. And there was a very nice article recently published in Emergency Medicine Clinics of North America. And that issue actually was entirely focused on psychiatric and behavioral emergencies. Within that issue was an article focused on geriatric psychiatric emergencies, which I don't think that we've really specifically talked about before. Authors of this article were Michelle Fisher and Monica Corsetti. It's a very nice and very focused and relevant article. Well, joining me to talk about this topic is once again Dr. Rob Flint. Now, last month, Rob talked about geriatric trauma issues. And this month, he's going to talk about geriatric psychiatric issues. And you'll clearly see a little bit of overlap between the two topics. And so anyway, Rob, welcome back to EMCast. It's great to have you returning with us.
Thanks, Amal. It's great to be back. And I'm really looking forward to talking about this topic. I think it is very relevant to emergency medicine practice.
All right. Well, let's jump right in. Well, one of the things that you brought up last month and that we briefly talked about was this confusion between delirium and dementia in trauma patients. But of course, this applies to all elderly patients with any acute trauma or medical type of illness. And it often results in misdiagnoses. So let's get into this a little bit more than we did last month. Can you briefly talk about these two diagnoses, dementia, delirium, and any pearls on how to make this distinction?
Yeah, I think it's vitally important we distinguish between the two. If we miss delirium and attribute it to dementia, we're going to miss the underlying cause, which is going to lead to morbidity and mortality. So dementia is a really slow, gradual decline in memory, inability to perform their activities of daily living. It's a very slow, unperceptible onset. And really, we should never know when the onset time is. Versus delirium, which is an acute change in mental status. And really, you can often pinpoint when these events began to start. So delirium can be defined as a disturbance in attention and awareness that develops over a brief period, represents an acute change from baseline. And I think that word baseline is important to us. And it's a change in baseline attention and awareness and tends to fluctuate in severity throughout the day. Delirium also involves a disturbance in cognition. And it really can't be better explained by a pre-existing neurocognitive disorder, severely reduced level arousal or coma, anything like that. So this article advocates using the Richmond Agitation Sedation Score to screen for delirium, which sounds daunting, but really isn't. It's a very short score that's going to help you characterize their level of activity, keeping in mind that delirium can be hyperactive, hypoactive, or even normal active. So it helps us delineate which level they're at. And then it'll help us know if we need to further evaluate for delirium. Their next suggestion to look for delirium is actually just have the patient spell lunch backwards. If they're able to do that with one or two mistakes, they really don't have delirium. Now, if they screen positive on the Richmond score or they fail the ability to spell lunch backwards, they're much more likely to have delirium. And they talk about using a brief confusion assessment model to look at this, which looks for altered mental status, inattention, altered level of consciousness, and disorganized thinking. All of this can be done in just a few minutes and has a sensitivity of 84%, but a specificity of 96%. So if in doubt, there are some tools out there that can help you differentiate between delirium and dementia. And I think, as we talked about, the ability to identify deviation from baseline is really important for figuring out where we need to go next in evaluating these patients.
Sounds great. You know, I'll bet you that 90% of the people that are listening, including myself, just tried to spell lunch backwards after you mentioned it. You know, I think I passed, but it was a little bit concerning how long it took me to do that. So anyway, let's move forward before I do develop a true delirium or dementia. The authors make the point that depression is often under-recognized in the elderly. In fact, we've seen patients in whom severe depression ends up mimicking dementia. So there's a lot of overlap between all three of these Ds, delirium, dementia, depression also. Can you talk to us about some key points regarding depression and also suicide risk as well? You had touched on that last month in your trauma talk as well.
Yeah, so the first thing to know is depression is not a normal part of aging. Aging patients definitely have a high prevalence of depression, but it's not normal and it's not something we have to accept and it's not something we shouldn't address. Some studies do show that its prevalence is up to 50% in older patients, so we should be screening for it. It's especially common in the patients with dementia, as you mentioned. Multiple studies have noted that the risk of suicide is related to the following factors. So if you have a severely depressed patient, if they have psychiatric comorbidities such as anxiety or substance use disorder, poor health status, or loss of functionality. There's also a significant overlap of symptoms between the depression and medical illness. So really hard to tease out sometimes what your medical patients are experiencing versus having depression and the comorbidities that associate with that. Look for things like loss of energy, loss of appetite, insomnia, and those with somatic complaints that you can't explain are really often signs of depression, and they require us to work a little harder to differentiate the somatic complaints from the depression. I think our biggest failure is not considering depression and asking directly about it. We should ask about loneliness, loss of motivation, or thoughts of self-harm. Interestingly, around 75% of patients who commit suicide in this age range have seen their primary care provider within the last month, and a percentage of like 33% have seen a primary care provider in the last week. So this is our chance to intervene. This is our chance to do screening. We should be on the lookout for it, and we should be asking questions about it.
Oh, great pearls. It is kind of a tough job that we're talking about here. For patients presenting with presumed psych problems in the emergency department, elderly patients, that is, it really seems like there are so many things to consider in elderly patients. How do we initially evaluate these patients in the emergency department?
Yeah, these are challenging patients, and these are the ones that are going to take a little time. So whether we want to admit it or not, they're going to take time and effort, and they really require our best detective work. We need to find any additional resources we can to understand the history, the living condition, the medication history, their risk for depression, their risk for suicide. And really, again, going back to baseline, what is this patient's baseline before their presentation today? What is the reason for presentation today? It's usually from a deviation from their baseline. So understanding what this patient's functionality is a week ago, a month ago versus today can really help us understand, is this a gradual decline or a much more acute decline? And how do we have to intervene? What medical issues do we need to be looking for? So we really need to rely heavily on other resources other than the patient sometimes to give us the data we need to figure out our next steps.
Yeah. And in a busy emergency department, it's oftentimes tough to do that, but it's one of the things that just has to be done. Well, one of the things that we all learn about is in the elderly patients to be on the lookout for is medication, side effects, and polypharmacy. And that could be an entire separate discussion in and of itself. But can you briefly talk to us about some key points we need to remember about medications in the elderly?
Yeah, my personal approach is to always ask, are there any new medications? Have there been changes in medications? And have they stopped taking medications either as directed or because they've become non-compliant? And often the answer to that question is going to give you a clue to the source of the patient's delirium. It could be a new medication. It could be their non-compliance. But if you can differentiate if there's any medication changes, you're often going to be in the right direction for finding delirium. And remember, this patient population has multiple prescribers. So there's a high possibility they're either over-medicated, there's medication reactions, or they're on medications that may not be necessary. So ask them how they take their medications. If they bring you this big bag of medications all mixed together, there's a really good chance they don't know how to take their medications and they're not taking them appropriately. That we've all seen that sign of the garbage bag dropped with all the medication. That's a sign that we have an issue. And really, we need to tease through what they're taking, what they're not taking. Ask them how they take it and if anybody helps them with it. Do they use a pill organizer? There's just a lot of little things you can ask about to try to get a better sense of their medication history, their medication compliance, and see if they're toxic because of some of the things that are going on there.
Got it. Now, in the evaluation process, as the authors are writing up this article, they return to the topic of delirium during the evaluation process. So let's talk a little bit about that once again. Once you have diagnosed delirium, so let's say you've distinguished between delirium versus dementia, this patient has delirium. Once you're heading down that pathway, how would you recommend we work up and manage patients with delirium, and especially patients with agitation? I realize this is kind of a bigger question, so I'm just going to let you run with that. So what are we doing with patients that have delirium? And it, also, if you could specifically address the agitated delirium patient.
So our first concern is safety, safety for the staff and safety for the patient. That's our overriding issue and our most important issue here. So we're going to try to create a calm, quiet environment and really try to verbally de-escalate and redirect these patients if possible. Talk slow and directly to the patient and give them time to process your statements. Their cognition may be a little slower. So this is, again, someone not to come in pressured speech, really aggressive. Give them their personal space. Try to give them a sense of control in a calm, quiet environment. And it's interesting. Every department seems to have that one staff member who really connects with these patients and is almost like a grandmother whisperer. Let them spend some time with the patient, see if they can verbally de-escalate, because that's the most beneficial outcome for the patient and the staff, is that we can just verbally get things back on track. Now, that doesn't always happen. And if we have to go to either chemical or physical restraints, that's when we need to be even more cautious. If we have to do physical restraints, let's make sure we have enough staff to safely restrain the patient, get the restraints on without hurting the staff or the patient. And let's aim for a very short period of time for those physical restraints to be in place. Skin breakdown and rhabdomyolysis are much more common in older patients who are restrained. So let's aim for a very short period of time for physical restraints. When we talk about chemical restraints, the article really points out nicely that we should start with antipsychotics. And if a patient's already on it, we should just give them an additional dose of what they're on. And these are things like Haldol, Risperidol, Olanzapine. Those are should be our go-to medications. Now, if we can give it to them orally, that's the ideal situation. If we have to escalate to IV or intramuscular medications, think about low dosing first and then slowly escalating as we need to. So these are, again, patients to be patient with and give them a low dose, let it work. And if that doesn't, slowly escalate. We should probably be avoiding benzodiazepines in these patients because they can actually lead to worsening delirium and agitation. And really, let's stick to the antipsychotics first and use those to their dose maximums before we start adding other medications in.
Excellent. Well, that was a really, really helpful discussion in this nice general overview of geriatric psychiatric emergencies. Robert, any final points you want to leave the listeners with?
I think it's really important we consider delirium and depression in our geriatric population. If we don't ask questions, we're not going to get answers. So ask about depression, ask about loneliness, especially if the somatic complaints aren't adding up. There's probably some underlying social or psychiatric illness that needs to be addressed. And these patients take time and hard work. So we just have to be patient and try to get that whole picture by gathering outside sources to give us the information that we need, whether that's the medical record, primary care doctors, family members, friends, neighbors. We just need to reach out and try to get as much data as we can on these patients. And when in doubt, go slow and just slowly titrate your medications up.
All right. Fantastic pearls. Dr. Flint, thank you so much for your time and taking us through this article. And look forward to getting back together to discuss some other topics really soon.
Thanks, Amo. Appreciate the time.
All right, folks, it is time for our wrap up. And as you recall, the first topic that we addressed was risk management. Dr. Rob Flint went over a few articles that were published recently pertaining to risk management in emergency medicine. And of course, those of us here in the United States always worry about the threat of malpractice. But frankly, wherever you work, even if you work in the U.S. in a non-litigious area or you work in a different country where med mal is not a big deal, none of us want to make mistakes. And so I like talking about risk management because typically lawsuits and risk management issues relate directly to the kind of things that we all end up missing. Whether you get sued or not, we need to know about the common misses and how to avoid those common misses. And frankly, if you can decrease risk, you're improving patient care. Anyway, with regards to these articles, studies show that we in emergency medicine, surprisingly, are not actually disproportionately named in lawsuits compared to other specialties. Now, that may differ a little bit based on the literature that you read. I've seen some articles that say that emergency medicine and a few other procedure-based specialties do get sued more often. These articles did not seem to suggest that. Fortunately, most emergency medicine claims do not end in payment, although surprisingly, this was a surprise to me, claims that involve trainees do more often involve money changing hands. I'm not exactly sure why that is. It's possible that trainees, being employees of the hospital, will end up resulting in a lawsuit against the hospital. And because hospitals typically have deeper pockets, they tend to pay out a little bit more. I'm not exactly sure why that may be the case. We'll have to look into some other research about that. Areas of relatively high litigation are, no surprise, missed acute coronary syndrome and missed myocardial infarction are common. Missed appendicitis is still common. That's a bit of a surprise because it seems like we just get CAT scans on so many people now. And I wonder whether that may be because there's a lot of pediatric cases of missed appendicitis, and we don't tend to CAT scan kids nearly as often. So maybe those missed appendicitis cases reflect a greater number of pediatric patients in those studies. Anyway, that's still listed as top five in a number of different articles that I've seen before. Wounds and missed retained foreign bodies, that's very, very common. The payouts there are not huge, but they're very common causes of litigation. So don't blow off those wounds. You've got to do good wound care and look for foreign bodies. Missed fractures still remains a common cause of malpractice. No surprise, missed strokes account for a lot of malpractice as well. Missed aortic problems, aortic dissection, ruptured aortic aneurysms, and so on. And Rob also mentioned that missed meningitis and pediatric fever still is out there despite vaccines. Of course, we know that there is a large number of people, perhaps even growing number of people, who are anti-vaccine or anti-vaxxers, and maybe this reflects an increase in the number of people that are declining vaccines. In terms of preventable errors that are consistently associated with litigious situations, I was surprised a little bit by lack of documentation of family history. That's oftentimes cited in lawsuits. Now, I've been involved in consulting in a number of lawsuits, and actually, I do recall a number of times where failure to document family history or failure to take into account family history gets cited by the plaintiff side, and I don't know what to make of that. Family history may not really contribute a lot to the actual case, but what I will say is that it's an easy question to ask, it's easy to document. And the way the plaintiff attorneys seem to play this out is by just making the physician look that like he or she was sloppy. If you're not documenting simple things like family history, they will make it seem like you're just a sloppy, incomplete physician that didn't take a good history in front of the jury. And every layperson out there who's on a jury knows that you're supposed to ask about family history. And I think that's why this ends up showing up in a lot of these cases. Does knowing the family history make a huge difference? Not a huge difference, but it does make you look bad when you haven't documented it. You haven't even asked about it. Rob talked about the 3 D's approach: dialogue, documentation, and discharge. Dialogue, referring to trying to spend a decent amount of time with the patient and family. Documentation, make sure to review all documentation. Review the nursing notes, review the triage vital signs. I see that oftentimes missed, and any available medical records and collateral information. And then discharge is the 3rd D. You want to make sure that the patient has time-specific discharge instructions in terms of follow-up. The patient needs to know exactly what they need to do for whatever they're being discharged with. And before they go, make sure you repeat and reevaluate and look at those vital signs. That's something that we actually started doing at university a number of years ago. And it's surprising how often patients are written for discharge and the patient's going to be discharged, and yet they're a little bit low blood pressure or a little bit tachycardic. And you say, no, they're not ready for discharge yet. I can't imagine the number of times that patients have been discharged from our emergency department before we implemented the policy that vital signs must be reviewed and signed off on before the patient goes home. You've got to look at those vital signs. And I promise you, if you start doing that routinely on patients that you are discharging, there's going to be a handful of cases that you say, you know what, let's not discharge this patient just yet because the vitals need a little bit more work. Common errors that lead to malpractice when a mid-level provider is involved include misdiagnosis, infections, fractures, tendon injuries. Again, very common things that many mid-level providers will deal with. And also, Rob talked a little bit about trainees, and the surprising thing there, as I mentioned, was that cases involving trainees are more likely, much more likely, in fact, to end with the payout and end with the verdict in favor of the patient rather than a defense verdict. Most trainees are employed by the hospital, and so a lot of times the trainees, specifically residents, get pulled into the lawsuits because that allows the plaintiff side to pull the hospital in to the lawsuit. That's what I alluded to earlier. The hospital has deeper pockets, they have much more money, and I think that probably just increases the likelihood that the plaintiff side is going to end up taking home some money after the case is done. So if you're a resident out there listening to this, don't assume that just because you are a resident, you are not going to get pulled into lawsuits. If you are involved in a case, it might even be more likely that you and the nurses will get pulled into lawsuits because that gives the plaintiff side the opportunity to pull the hospital, your employer, the hospital into the lawsuit as well. Next, we talked about cervical artery dissection with Dr. Lloyd Tannenbaum. Cervical artery dissection refers to a dissection involving either the carotid or vertebral artery, and it occurs because of a compromise in the arterial wall. The dissection can lead to luminal stenosis, and that stenosis can produce hypoperfusion or thromboembolic complications. Most commonly, we see these in patients that are presenting with stroke type of symptoms, and overall, it accounts for only about 2% of all strokes. But in young patients presenting with stroke symptoms, this is something that you've got to consider. It actually accounts for up to a quarter of all stroke presentations in patients under the age of 45. So keep this in mind, and that becomes a routine part of our workup to evaluate the vertebral and carotid arteries for dissection when patients show up with a stroke. Patients can present with all kinds of strange neurologic symptoms, oftentimes symptoms that don't really nicely, neatly localize to a specific arterial distribution. And so when things don't really seem to localize to a specific area, one of the things that you've got to think about is the cervical artery dissection. There's all kinds of etiologies that have been identified, and I don't know that I believe that any one of these that Lloyd mentioned are a definite cause. Many of these are just normal daily activities. He talked about painting a ceiling or intense coughing or any type of Valsalva and so on. My guess is that there's just some type of minor trauma that the patient often doesn't remember, and they are predisposed for whatever reason. Maybe they have a genetic problem, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or Marfan's or osteogenesis imperfecta or whatever it is that produces some underlying weakness. And then they add just a little bit of some type of exertion, and that is enough to cause the dissection. So there's obviously a lot of different risk factors, but think about the typical risk factors that we think about with aortic dissection or with other vascular problems. Clinical presentation, again, can be very, very nonspecific. The patients presenting with classic stroke symptoms are the easy ones. They get the workup, but keep this in mind also when you've got patients presenting with persistent nonspecific headaches or persistent nonspecific neck pain. Carotid artery dissections often produce the frontal or temporal headaches, whereas the vertebral artery dissections are more commonly associated with occipital or posterior headaches or neck pain. And because this is so vague, it's not uncommon for the initial dissection to be missed on the first presentation, and on average, there tends to be about a 9-day delay in diagnosis after the initial visit. So one might argue that standard of care is to not make the diagnosis on that first visit. That's something that I would argue, just because the presentations are so vague. Patients can come in with pain in the eyes or in the ears or the face or teeth or pulsatile tinnitus. I mean, when these patients show up, what are you thinking? You're probably not thinking of dissection. Well, it's something that you should probably try to remember as a possibility. Classically, they'll present with stroke symptoms. Also classic is the Horner syndrome due to compression of sympathetic fibers. They may come in with cranial neuropathies, with cranial nerves 9 and 12 being the most common. And strokes do tend to occur often in the first couple of weeks of dissection. Again, the patients with cranial neuropathies and classic stroke symptoms are the easy ones, but those vague headaches and vague neck pain, those are much, much tougher, and those are the ones that oftentimes get diagnosed much later on. And these patients, by the way, can also present with subarachnoid hemorrhage, So one of the things that I've learned is that if a subarachnoid hemorrhage is diagnosed, we'll often go back and order a CT angiogram, not only of the brain, but also try to include the neck, because those cervical vessels might be the cause of the subarachnoid hemorrhage. Again, CTA of the head and neck is the best immediate diagnosis. Lloyd mentioned that if the diagnosis is not made on a CTA, usually it is because it's more than 90% sensitive and specific, but if the diagnosis is not made on a CTA, but you still have a very strong suspicion, then the next step would be to get an MRI-MRA. Gold standard is digital subtraction angiography. That's certainly not something that we're typically ordering from the emergency department. A common concern is, what if these patients present with classic stroke symptoms and you're thinking about giving them thrombolytics? Well, fortunately, the studies seem to suggest that thrombolytics are not contraindicated in the setting of stroke due to cervical artery dissection. So if you know somebody has a dissection, then you're not going to give it. But if you give it because you didn't know they actually had a dissection, chances are you have not caused any further harm. So thrombolytics don't tend to produce significant worsening of these patients. The main thing that you want to do once you diagnose these patients is to prevent an ischemic stroke subsequently. And there's controversy about what I'm about to say. Most people recommend that these patients should be put on some type of anticoagulation, whether that is a true anticoagulant like warfarin or heparin or just antiplatelet agents. It's variable. There's some people that I've heard and some articles that I've read also that suggest that these antiplatelet agents and anticoagulants really don't do anything. So the jury's still out about what the best form of therapy is to prevent ischemic strokes. But I think most people, if you make the diagnosis, most people will recommend starting something. Unfortunately, the prognosis is pretty good. 60 to 85% of patients will completely heal within a year. There is about a 10 to 50% recurrence rate, usually in the first couple of months after the diagnosis. And again, fortunately, these patients have a fairly low mortality rate, less than 5%. So thanks to Lloyd for taking us through that article on a diagnosis that we are making more and more. The next thing we talked about was hypoglycemia with Dr. Gabriella Miller. This is an interesting condition. You figure hypoglycemia is really easy. Just give them a turkey sandwich and you're done. But unfortunately, it's not that easy. We've had a number of patients in our emergency department where we correct the hypoglycemia and then an hour, hour and a half later, they're hypoglycemic once again. And we keep giving them more and more and more dextrose and more food and carbohydrates, and we think it's going to turn around. And we've unfortunately had to admit some of these patients overnight for continued workup and on a dextrose drip because they keep dropping their sugar down, even though it wasn't an overdose. There's a number of different reasons why this can happen. And this was also definitely a surprise to me. I always figured that hypoglycemia occurs because of concurrent illnesses, for example, sepsis, that's possible, or because they took too much of their insulin and didn't eat, that's possible also. But there's a number of other medications that can drop your sugar down as well, including NSAIDs and valproic acid and SSRI antidepressants and antibiotics and ethanol. That's not a surprise, but the others were definitely a surprise to me. And then you can also have isolated hyperinsulinemia from the insulin or endogenous production, for example, an insulinoma. And also post-gastric bypass surgery patients are at higher risk as well. So have a low threshold for getting that finger stick, monitor the blood sugar, get carbs on board, and most of the time you'll be able to reverse it. But if not, you may end up needing to take another step and get them admitted. You might consider use of intramuscular glucagon if you can't get IV access. If it is an overdose of an insulin secretagogue, for example, a sulfonylurea medication, those are the patients in whom octreotide seems to work. And of course, you want to look for underlying causes like underlying illness, sepsis, and so on. Most of these patients will eventually be dischargeable from the emergency department, but you do want to make sure that you've monitored them for a handful of hours, maybe the proverbial 4 to 6 hour observation, just to make sure that their sugar is not continuing to drop. Make sure they're eating, make sure they're alert, make sure they have good social supports, they're back to baseline, and also that they can get help if symptoms recur. So it's probably a good idea for them to have somebody else at home with them monitoring and observing them in case they do have a delayed recurrence. And we finish things up with a discussion of geriatric psychiatric emergencies, in particular dementia versus delirium, which, you know, unfortunately, this is something that's often misdiagnosed, one for the other. It's a big problem when patients present with delirium and they're assumed to simply have dementia. Just to clarify once again, dementia is a slow, gradual decline in the activities of daily living. The time of onset often cannot be pinpointed. It's very gradual and longstanding. Delirium, on the other hand, is defined as a disturbance in attention and awareness that develops over a brief period of time and represents an acute change from baseline, and it tends to fluctuate quite a bit. That's one of the key features, whereas dementia is slow and progressive. Delirium fluctuates a lot, and it occurs just within a very brief preceding period of time. Diagnosis of delirium generally requires some type of assessment of arousal, and Rob Flint was back to talk about some potential scores that can be used here. One of the things that he suggested was spelling the word lunch backwards as a test of cognitive awareness and ability to maintain attention, which typically is lost in delirium. And I really love that, spelling the word lunch, or what I had learned before was to spell the word world backwards. Again, about five letters or so. If somebody has reasonable attention span, they should be able to spell that word backwards. But patients with delirium typically just can't do that. The other thing I learned was one of the earliest markers of delirium is loss of three-item recall. So that's something that I've oftentimes used. It wasn't mentioned in this article, but just ask the patient to cite three objects. Ask the patient to repeat three objects, for example, and then 5 minutes later, ask them to repeat those same three objects. And loss of five-minute three-item recall is one of the earliest markers of delirium. So you can give that a try as well. Depression is oftentimes misdiagnosed as dementia, and that's really unfortunate because depression oftentimes is something that is reversible, whereas dementia is not. And so if a patient has severe depression that's misdiagnosed as dementia, then that represents a huge miss because you've missed out on opportunity to treat a patient. You always want to make sure to obtain collateral history, ask specific questions about suicidality, and also ask about new medications, because in the elderly, sometimes new medications can produce a delirium or depression type of picture, or even a dementia type of picture. So make sure you always get a good medication history on elderly patients. In terms of management of delirium, just to round things out, first you want to ensure patient and staff safety. You want to create a calm and quiet environment. Talk slowly and allow the patient to process what you're talking about with verbal de-escalation. Talk slowly and allow them to process what you're saying with verbal de-escalation. If physical or chemical restraints are required, use short-acting ones and start with low doses, typically antipsychotics, and we've really moved away from benzodiazepines because they actually tend to increase the delirium. All right, folks, well, that does it for our summary of the May issue of EMED Home's EMCast. My thanks to all of our speakers, Drs. Rob Flint, Gabriella Miller, and Lloyd Tannenbaum for their contributions to our four topics today. Hope these were helpful to all of you, and I look forward to talking to all of you next month. Bye for now.